I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello again, everybody. This is The Rut from The Times and The Sunday Times. And thanks a million once again for joining us. I'm Stephen Jones of The Sunday Times. This week, I'm joined in the studio by two promising young journalists. Please be don't be too hard on them. Will Kelleher from The Times and equally promising, although slightly less young, Al Dimmock, features editor of Rugby World.
It's been a while since I've been called young, Stephen.
Boys, we're in an exciting time for the game. Al, where were you? What have you seen on the weekend? What excited you or what put you off rugby for life or whatever?
Oh, I was in Charles. People talk an awful lot about second screen experiences. Well, I was mainly on childcare duty all weekend. So having to make sure that a child doesn't stumble into the fire whilst watching rugby. Thankfully, there was a lot of entertaining rugby on.
What you're trying to say is you didn't go to a game?
Yes, that's
right, okay. Thank you very much. Yeah.
I decided to put myself through watching the Irish teams as much as possible just to get a closer look at them. For my sins, I couldn't do that for the Bath game, and I'm sure we'll get stuck into that, but it was I just felt cruel watching that one. But yeah, certainly saw an awful lot of Ulster and Munster and a bit of Connacht as well.
Okay, just you mentioned before we came on air, the four Irish provinces really gone well. I mean, look, they concentrate totally on this, but Ulster actually probably the least publicised of the four in a way, but you think that they're coming through, especially behind the scrum?
Yes, absolutely, and I'd love to talk to it in a bit of detail. I've been taking a closer look at the talented young guys they've got on the back line there, but Ulster, at the start of the season, before they announced that they were signing Dwayne Vermeulen, there was nothing on the signings front, and everyone thought, geez, COVID has really hit them very, very hard. And, you know, I think Johnny Petrie, who's the CEO there, has spoken openly and honestly about how difficult a time it's been through this pandemic. But when you've got talent, young talent coming through, and I'll hopefully talk a bit later about that when we get into Europe and also the Six Nations. But guys like James Hume, Balakun, and Michael Lowry, who at 5'7" has been a real pocket rocket and caught everyone by surprise, that the talent they've come through is a real credit to the system that they've got there.
Have they got a chance of winning the Champions Cup?
Well, they're up against it, certainly. I mean, we can get into the shakeout of this European tournament and just what the hell. I mean, you're more likely to follow the plot of Inception than you are to follow the plot of this European season and how the table has panned out. But poor old Ulster have given it a good old whack in Europe and looked exceptional doing so. And just by the dint of results and COVID cancellations, they're facing Toulouse in the next two rounds of the 16. So good luck to them.
That's a tough one. We are coming. We're going to go game by game for the next round shortly. Will, just tell us about your weekend, at least the things you can reveal.
Yeah, no, I went to Harlequins on Friday night, which was very classic Quins, sort of let Caster get 14-0 up and then decided to start playing, and a few questionable decisions maybe by Mike Adamson on the referee at the end allowed Alex Dunbrandt to seal his hat-trick and win the game with exactly the same scoreline as the week before when they beat Cardiff 36-33 as well. So that was where I was, and the Stoop was a happy place on Friday night.
I don't think we can be downbeat about referees, and if we go into refereeing this weekend, we're going to get subterranean, frankly. So we won't. Let's keep the upbeat theme.
Well, I listened last week when Will was talking about fashion, and I did notice some questionable footwear from one of the referees.
Oh, yes.
But maybe we were best not to go into that
walking
one either.
Walking boots, weren't they?
Well, the one referee I saw, he had his whistle in the wrong place, that was for sure. But I was at the Rec. I think it could easily be spelt with a W now because it is looking really old and tired. It probably always did, but that was when they were winning. Bath 7, Leinster 64. And have to tell you that Bath's commitment in that game wasn't too bad, and that probably shows you how bad they were. But let's be fair, Leinster looked an absolute pedigree team. Johnny Sexton has had his problems with, you think now and again, his heart's not in it or his body's not in it. He played, he was as sharp as I've ever seen him on the weekend. Also, they've got, as Al says with Ulster, Leinster have got players coming through. Bath, it's almost a root and branch thing there. I tend to think behind the scenes it's not good at all. And I think that this horrible, horrible thing to say, but I think people on the field and off the field have to leave, because that's the brutality of professional rugby. And I think quite a few of them do. Leinster, for me, probably marginal favourites now to take the tournament. Okay, coming up on this week's podcast, we look back on the weekend's, we look back in detail on the weekend's round of European fixtures. Premiership Rugby have announced a landmark TV deal that would see the games, or some of the games, back on free-to-air. And we've got Premiership Rugby's chief executive, Simon Massey-Taylor, to join us. So very interesting. Jess Hayden will round up the latest in the women's game, and we'll also go through Eddie Jones's England squad. It baffled many and totally baffled everybody else. And we'll also have our God or Goddess of the Week with some strong contenders. First, let's get back into the latest round of European rugby. Racing and Cardiff seem, and Leicester seem to get 28-0 victories, Al. How much has these non-games detracted from the competition? And well, how unfair are they?
Well, the competition was already really hard to put a finger on before that. An interesting side note is that there were some disgruntled noises, particularly coming out of Ireland when it was decided that a couple of games, ones including Leinster, would have a 28-0 scoreline going against them, whereas some teams in France were able to muster a squad to put a fixture on with the bare bones of what they had, and they said, well, we could have done that as well. Interestingly, we've mentioned her name on this podcast a couple of times now, and it's always for political reasons, is Roxana Marceau, the sports minister in France. Decided that this week, when Toulouse were handed a 28-0 victory and it looked like they would need to get through by the skin of their teeth to qualify for the next round, suddenly sprung to action and sent a letter to EPCR decrying the nature of these 28-0 scorelines. But all is forgiven, I'm imagining, because Toulouse have managed to scrape through. But certainly it's another question mark on an already puzzling setup for Europe. And it's the real question is yes, okay, COVID allowing and all of that, will this look exactly the same next season? Because there's got to be serious discussions now about how this goes ahead. What benefits everyone, I suppose, and what really can wallpaper over the cracks here is that if we go through the fixtures of the next round, there's some cracking ties in there, and perhaps all will be forgotten by the time that those kick off and we go, oh, this is the cream of Europe.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that hopefully by the time we get to these double-headed last 16 games, it's April, we're out the back of winter and things are a bit more improved. But one thing I wanted to mention was, it's interesting, isn't it, on the point of testing, and we're not epidemiologists here on the Ruck, but what they've been doing now in the NFL, now they're in the playoffs, is they're not actually testing their players every day like we are in the Premiership Rugby and European Rugby on lateral flows. They're almost like spot-checking teams and testing some of the unvaccinated players a bit more. And I wonder whether that might be the future for sport, that it's almost a bit like drug testing when you go in and do a spot check rather than testing everyone every week, every day, because you're going to get to the point where you find reasons to cancel these games.
Well, I would say with drug testing, that's also because the menu of tests available is decided by how big your pot is and how much money you can put towards it.
Yes.
However, I take your point, Will, in that perhaps we get to a point where we go, do we need to be putting this outlay of cash on everything and spring everyone, whereas maybe it makes more sense to narrow down that pot of tests.
It's a hell of an expensive business as well. I mean, a round of PCR tests for an English club is £10,000, I think. And when they've got, Bristol have said over this European pool stage, they've lost £300,000 just having the cancellation of the sale, Scarlets game, and then losing £50,000 on a chartered plane that they didn't take to Paris. So, yeah, let's hope by the knockouts that 28-0s are an actual scoreline rather than one that's just preordained.
We'll just go on to the next round of European stuff in a minute, but Will, I just want to ask you about two clubs. Neither Bristol nor Sale have got a magnificent record in European Cup. matches. They're not seen as big Euro campaigners. Suddenly, Bristol came bursting out all over against Scarlets in a tight game, scored loads of points in the last quarter, played brilliantly. So too Sale against the Ospreys. Now, they're not, as I say, they're not normally seen as contenders. Do you think they give they are making a late run, or was that just a one-off game?
The Bristol one was interesting, wasn't it? Because it was so very tight, and then they ran away with it in the last few minutes of the game by three late tries. And actually, if you combine the two results between those English teams and the Welsh teams, it was 101-31 combined score, 15 tries to 3, which isn't too pretty for the Welsh teams, is it? But Sale, Alex Sanderson was asked after the game up at the AJ Bell whether he thought that they could win the tournament, and he said, yeah, why not? I mean, we've got guys like Faf de Klerk to come back into the side. They've got a really cool crop of young players there as well, guys like Bevan Rodd and Aaron Reid and all those guys. I mean, they could be contenders, I think, but it's a hell of a draw, isn't it? I mean, those two now, Bristol and Sale, are now against each other, and the winner of that is going to play the winner of the Parisian Derby. And often in the last few years, Racing have been one of those sort of nearly teams that have made the final a lot and are due a win. So that's a tough draw, isn't it? But they're on a good side of it with La Rochelle, Bordeaux, Quins and Montpellier if they do get through.
Will, I know that we've been talking earlier about you would change the elite nature of the competition, but we'll come to you in a second. Al, this is the holy grail for all the Irish teams. I think it's a notch or two down the priorities for some of the others, especially the English, because they've just got so many other commitments. Are you happy with, or let's put it this way, where do they go next year with the format for the Champions Cup? Because you've got to be careful. Just because you call it the Champions Cup doesn't mean it'll always be number one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the conversation around this is different this week than it was last week. For example, we were all decrying the disgrace that was Montpellier and what they pulled in. And I listened to the podcast last week and with interest to Will's point about the season structure and making it more elite and having the top four. If the same Montpellier from last week had been, they would have still made this elite competition because they're in the top four and the top 14. So it's an interesting one. Where do your priorities lie? Because it feels still traditionally like there's a handful of clubs that in France in particular prioritise Europe. Toulouse, it's part of their rich heritage and it's they are rugby daft and it's crazy. La Rochelle, particularly under O'Gara now, it feels like something that they feel is a destiny for a club that has been rising through the ranks on the Atlantic coast there. Munster and Leinster, big part of their identity. For everyone else, it depends where they see their trajectory as a club. So, for example, this is an incredible moment for Connacht to come through to the knockouts. And you have to say, a fine reward for the brilliant rugby they've been played. Will they come a cropper? The big debate in Ireland at the moment is the fact that Connacht probably don't have the front five depth to pull through, and their resources are completely stretched, and eventually it'll catch up with them. If you change the elite nature of the club, will someone like, okay, Montpellier have come through and with that result at the weekend and actually are wondering, well, are we a big team? Against Quins over two legs, will they decide that that's as important come April time as the top 14? It's hard to tell. But so it depends. You can't say to someone, you're in the top, you're top three of your league. Do you really fancy Europe? Do you want to give it a go? I think I was on an Irish podcast last week and we were talking about this, and my point, my point had been, is the genie out the bottle with this one? Now the response I got back was, this has always been the case, this has been ever thus. Let's not look back with rose tinted glasses and say that the French have always prioritised the European Cup. But what we do glory in is the ones that do, and that's why Will's probably right. By the time we narrow it down to the round of 16, when we see the cream of the crop and the people that really care, it'll be fun again.
You want fewer teams, Will?
Yeah, I think so. And I think actually, I don't think that the sort of, I don't know, lack of trying is a bit of a punchy thing to say, but the French teams giving away huge results is not just a French problem. I mean, we saw the Bath result the weekend, and it's what a difference a week makes with Wasps. I mean, we were praising them. They got a hat-trick on the God of the Week last week, and this week they had a tough afternoon in Munster. And on your point about priorities, I would probably say that in their heart of hearts, they're probably quite annoyed that they didn't make it into a last 16. But actually, with players coming back, with a squad that's been paper thin for a number of months now, having a real attack on the back half of the Premiership is probably in their wheelhouse now, which is fine. And you see this in the football sometimes, don't you, where teams have a great season in the Premier League and then get into the Champions League or Europa League and then almost gets in the way of some of their league form, doesn't it? So I don't think it's an exclusive problem to French clubs. I mean, we've had years of underachieving English clubs in the top European competitions as well.
I think there's also some rough justice in there amongst the, if we take out the 28 nils and the COVID disruptions, people not caring, there's still some rough justice in there. So Glasgow Warriors, for example, were cock-a-hoop after beating Exeter in the fog, and they put on a phenomenal performance, and it was almost that beautifully ugly moment where you've got a team playing at their best and Exeter playing at their worst. Fast forward to the next two rounds and Glasgow are handily beaten, look out of it, and they just don't feel like they deserve to be in the knockout round. So if you care to look, there's still that sense that the better teams will come through. It's just few or far between at the moment.
We've given the tournament a little bit of a knocking now, but just listen to this, because I'm going to ask you now, guys. I'm going to tell you the remind you of the fixtures in the next round, which is the first leg of home and away. You give me the winners, but blimey, how tasty are they? They're first of all, Racing 92 against Stade Français. I mean, that has, in previous years, attracted 80,000 to the Stade de France. Who do you fancy there, Al?
I think Stade were absolutely buzzing to get that win this weekend, but I just don't think... I think this is too big for Racing, and I just can't see them coughing it up.
The only thing is, I think the Racing have never quite got there, and I just wonder whether they'll start panicking like Clermont Auvergne used to in the French final. Will?
Yeah, no, I would back Racing for that.
Three Racings. Bristol, Sale, Al Dimmock. I mean, that could be a tremendous home and away. Tremendous home and away. Well, I mean, you're talking about capacity crowds for those, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, my answer to this is based purely on the fact that I saw Lude de Jager throw a backdoor offload the other day. So I'm just going to edge Sale on that one, I think.
Backdoor offload brought it home, yeah?
Sale. Yeah, I think Sale too. I think they've got more potential for growth, let's put it like that.
Yeah, true. Bristol did put them away recently, but there we go. Harlequins, Montpellier. Will they be playing the Montpellier who give up and bottle it, or the Montpellier who beat Exeter yesterday?
So I think as Quins are the sort of comeback kings at the moment, having the second leg of that at the Stoop might be helpful, because they might get beaten out in France, but then it's the whole Liverpool thing in the Champions League, isn't it, of the first leg away and then bring them back to the cop end, and anything can happen. So I'm going to back Quins for that one.
I think that'd be very tight. One we'd all like to go to, La Rochelle Bordeaux.
It's been on the West Coast. Tell you what, it's been a bucket list to see La Rochelle, but absolutely jumping. Yeah. Flares going off, yellow flags everywhere. Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal. I tell you what, Bordeaux are the great unknown in this competition. They're a phenomenal side. You don't know what you're going to expect from them. You don't know how fired up they're going to be. I suspect that they'll probably be pretty keen, so certainly that's going to be a tasty fixture. But based on been there, done that, got the t-shirt nicked off our back last season, I'll squeak La Rochelle there.
Squeak La Rochelle? Would you squeak, Will?
Well, yeah, La Rochelle, I think. But Bordeaux put away Bristol in this round last time, didn't they? And then La Rochelle put away Sale. So those are pretty tasty teams, but I think the La Rochelle beefy pack might...
Okay, well, we'll have a dissenter there. I might just sneak in for Bordeaux. Al, you've been bigging up Ulster, and now you're saying, oh, blimey, what bad luck they got to lose. That could still be unbelievably tight, though, couldn't it?
It could, absolutely. And I just want to take this moment to eulogise Ulster, I mentioned their back three guys. Last week I was speaking to some contacts in Ulster about particularly Michael Lowry and what makes him so special. 5'7". Weighs absolutely nothing soaking wet, but he is thriving in Europe in particular, but playing really well in the league as well. And the big thing I was told about him is I heard comparisons between him and Darcy Graham at Edinburgh and Cheslin Colby, not just for the footwork and the fact that you can step someone in a telephone box. And we saw clips of Lowry's scoop and run last week, and it was exceptional stuff. But the big thing I heard was incredibly brave, but with it, phenomenal footwork in contact, because a guy that small will get ragdolled and chucked about and can get seriously hurt. But he doesn't, because A, he's pretty tasty, but also he great leg drive, smart about where he goes and attacks that well. Hume was a stick-on to be in the Allen squad, and people were saying, oh, but will he displace Aki and Henshaw and Ringrose, who are all phenomenal players for the Ireland team? But actually, he's thrown himself in the mix. And the big one, the one that people reckon probably will get a run in the team at some point, is Balakun on the wing, who is just a phenomenal player. These guys have come through and they've been given the chance to play regularly when their backs have been against the wall and in a club that has ambitions but always seems to fall short season after season. And just something's coming right for them in Ulster at the moment. Against Toulouse, we know the depth of talent that they've got. Some of those guys have just fallen out of the France squad because they've got a COVID outbreak in the club there. But you expect they'll be back in time for Italy, those great names. And by the time this comes around in April, Toulouse love coming strong at the end of the season. And this is a team that is happy to contest two titles in the same season.
Yeah.
So you
won
just imagine,
last year, didn't they?
Yes, exactly. So, and we all saw the pictures of them wearing ski masks and getting champagne popped in their face. They're a team that love to win. They're a team that love to compete in all forms. And I just think it's maybe just a bit too much for Ulster.
Okay, so by a small margin, you're going for Toulouse, Ulster to lose. Will?
Yeah, Toulouse. I think. I mean, if Ulster were to pull it off, it'd be an unbelievable result and blow the tournament wide open. But yeah, I would back Toulouse, the champs.
Keep going, Will, because Munster. We know all about Munster. I don't think actually technically they're as good a side as Ulster or Leinster, but they've got incredible, implacable home form, especially. Exeter also come strong later in the season. Who do you fancy there?
Maybe the neutral is glad that that game's not happening in December or January. I remember going to Sandy Park a few years ago when they were both in the same pool, and we've all been down to Sandy Park and the wind howled down there and it was so bad that no one could get out of their 22, so the whole game was played in one corner of the pitch.
Well, we're sorry you got inconvenienced there.
I was fine up in the stands, but you know.
We'll get a radiator put next to you next time.
But yeah, I mean, that's a hell of a gritty one, isn't it? Munster and Exeter and the 5 metre merchants.
Tell you what
the winners are. Winner is.
I'm going to pump for Munster. There you go.
Interestingly, this is what a difference a couple of weeks makes. But in the URC, people were decrying the way that Munster were playing, the fact that they had made fewer passes as a team compared to the opposition scrum half and that kind of thing. And former Munster players they've won a couple of games in a row now. And in the last round there, Munster were actually playing some free flowing stuff. Ben Healy, he's only started a couple of league games for Munster in the URC. Just decided to start directing traffic. And will that be what they're like against Exeter? I don't think for a second that is what they will be like. But certainly the pressure's out. I mean, a lot of eyes will be on Munster and the way that they play. I think some people last week were saying, can we swap Johan van Graan into Bath now and change things up there? Which, I don't know about that. But
I think, okay, Munster or Exeter?
I think Munster, just.
I think Exeter will win with a bit to spare. The great games keep on coming. Leicester against Clermont Auvergne. Clermont are nothing like as good as they were, but at home they're almost as good as they were. Al?
Yeah, I mean, I just to know colours to the map, I see Leicester winning this one.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
You know, Clermont, they've not had one of those. They're not a current crop of Clermont players that you'd say this is a classic side. And I think they'd probably want a little bit of regeneration. Leicester, meanwhile, have completely transformed, and we've spoken. We don't need to go into great depth because we've spoken about them a lot.
We don't. I think that'll be tighter than people think. I agree with Leicester. Or three for Leicester.
Yeah, three hat-trick Leicester.
And for the final game, one of Al's favourite teams, Connaught, against Leinster. That's the only reward Connaught got for battling their way through. Al.
Yeah.
You can see them testing Leinster for the first 20, but not really after that.
No, I think they always pose lots of questions to the defensive structure. They always keep you guessing about where they're going. Jack Carty's in incredible form, but the big thing that people have said about Connaught is front five depth, a couple of injuries here or there, and suddenly they look paper thin up front. And it's just going to be one of those things where Leinster just have too much muscle, and the way Leinster play, it can be. There's something horrifically inevitable about it when they're in form.
Horrifically inevitable. Okay, we'll just hope that Will's not too cold when he gets down to wherever he's going as well. Just very, very briefly, in the Challenge Cup, Lyon beat Benetton, Edinburgh hammered Brive by 60, Zebre lost at home to Worcester, Toulon had one of those odd 28-0 victories over Newcastle, Gloucester 68, the once mighty Perpignan 19, Saracens 45, London Irish 24. Those were the results in the men's game this weekend. Now over to our Jess Hayden for her roundup of the latest from the women's game.
The Premier 15s was quieter than usual this weekend as it was used as a reserve week to field three fixtures that had been postponed earlier in the season due to coronavirus cases in the league. Wasps secured a losing bonus point in a second half comeback against Loughborough Lightning with tries from Maud Muir, Abby Dow, Heather Kerr and Sammy Wong, but it was not enough to stop the thunder of lightning at Twyford Avenue as Loughborough kept their lead for a 41-22 win. In Tyneside, Worcester Warriors took a bonus point win with their 74-5 defeat of DMP Durham Sharks. The Warriors scored 12 tries, including a hat-trick from outside centre Jade Sheckles, but the try of the game came from the last play. Ellen Murphy booted a perfectly weighted cross-field kick to be collected by Sarah Moreira, who sprinted down the touchline to finish the game. In Sale, Saracens found themselves in the rare position of being behind in the first half and struggled to keep their lead throughout the match. Sale Sharks scored two tries in the first 10 minutes, and even once Saracens overtook on the scoreboard, Sale were quick to level the score. Saracens were without a few key players but fought back to make it three wins from three in 2022 and kept their place at the top of the table in a 41-26 win. In other news, Wales used this reserve week as an opportunity to gather their newly turned professional women's squad for a training camp in preparation for the Women's Six Nations, which is due to take place this spring. So, the results from this weekend are DMP Durham Sharks 5, Worcester Warriors 74, Sale Sharks 26, Saracens 41, and finally, Wasps 22, Loughborough Lightning 41.
Thanks, Jess. Well, now we're joined by Simon Massey-Taylor, Premiership Rugby's new or newish chief executive. Simon, welcome. Thanks for coming to us. And I think immediately there's news from Premiership Rugby because that vexatious question of terrestrial TV against satellite TV, etc. You've made a stand, or at least you've made a declaration there, because some of the Premiership Rugby games starting this weekend are going to be on terrestrial. A big decision. What does that mean to you and to the clubs?
Yes, well, actually, first of all, thanks very much for having me on, and hello, everybody. Yeah, so the TV piece is really important to us, and the partnership with ITV is great news for the clubs and hopefully for fans as well. I think the balance of free-to-air and pay is obviously, as you point out, a debate everyone has. And I think it's got to be acknowledged, actually, first of all, from BT Sport for allowing us to do this. They actually see a huge amount of benefit for free-to-air for them, because they've built a really good platform and reputation around Premiership Rugby and broadcasting Premiership Rugby. And, you know, I think the figures speak for themselves at the moment as far as how well that's doing. But giving the platform and the league a bit more oxygen, I think, helps us all. And so this partnership with ITV, which will be five games for this season, starting off this weekend with Leicester Sale, but also crucially including the final this year, and then seven games in the final for the next couple of years after that.
Yes,
we hope just brings in that broader rugby audience that we know is there, and just needs to see more Premiership.
Do you, you were saying that the BT have there's good news, and they've fought a fight, and the are you saying that the figures are better, the actual viewing figures?
Yeah, I mean, this season we are about 30% up, I think, from our best season so far, which is obviously great news. And, you know, some of that's brought down to this, just, I guess, almost 10 years worth of investment from them in building that audience. But, you know, really, you know, we're reaching now, I think, a peak of almost 10 million for this season so far. So there's some really good figures.
Simon, just on that, you mentioned the it gives you a bit more oxygen to be seen by a terrestrial audience. It sounds like people are happy with the trajectory that things are travelling on BT Sport. But how much ceiling do you think there is, and why do you think that oxygen is so necessary? Because if things are trending upwards, how much more do you think you can get from going on terrestrial?
Well, I think going on terrestrial, clearly it accesses that broader, more casual rugby fan. And you'll see that over the next few months with the Six Nations. You know, you're going to have 7-8 million people tuning in to BBC and ITV to watch the Six Nations. And, you know, there is, given how exciting the Premiership is, there's no reason why you can't migrate some of those fans to watching more regular club rugby as well, where those international stars are playing week in, week out. And so really, you know, for us, the strategy and the plan is to try and be align ourselves more closely with the international game. And ITV are the broadcaster for the England Six Nations games. That also they're a Rugby World Cup broadcaster. So, you know, being where that rugby fan is and feeding off those big peak moments you have with the Six Nations and then bring them into the club game is part of the vision with ITV.
With the viewership trending in a way that people you sound happy with, how does that offset, and how could that potentially offset attendances? Where's the trend going for with that at the moment?
Yeah, we're watching attendances very closely, and I think the reality is that crowds are coming back more slowly than you'd hope off the back of COVID, and clearly over the Christmas break that just set things back further. But the general noise from the clubs and it is a positive one in that they're building back those crowds, and they feel very confident that, you know, towards the end of the season and certainly leading into next, that they'll be back to hopefully where they were, and you know you build again from there. The clubs, yeah, our clubs feel that free to air and just general exposure can only be a good thing, really, for drawing people in to actually attend the games, and so it's a virtuous circle. That's the intention.
Hi Simon, it's Will here, hope you're well. I just wanted to ask you one about the viewing figures and what sort of uptick you might expect on terrestrial. Can you help us with some of the figures and what would be a good Saturday afternoon viewership for BT Sport, and what might you expect for, let's say, the Sale-Leicester game on Sunday that's going to be on ITV?
Well, I mean, I think the round averages have been close to 200,000 and now far exceeding that, actually. I think the average for up to round 13 or for round 13 was, I think, about 240,000 for each of the three games. And then we've started to see peak audiences, for records being broken, where I think the Bear, on a Friday night, the Bear Sharks game was over a quarter of a million. And for Saturday audiences, the Quinns Chiefs game a couple of weeks ago was over 370,000. So these are really decent figures. And actually, if you compare them to previously, going back to my old job, but the RFU previous six autumn international figures on Sky, that represents about half a sort of an average England game against someone like Australia. So you're nudging that way anyway. And then you have the impact of free to air on top of that. And you know, you'd be hoping that through a combination of live and highlights, that you'd get at least over 500,000 there, really, and then you build to the final moment, which in time, you know, we want to have, you know, seven-figure broadcast figures. So yeah, you just start sort of chipping away at that 7-8 million of the international audience.
So Simon, back to Steve, I hear you in the excellent news, but one thing that we don't in the media, and I think out in the public, we haven't seen yet, is much more hands-on driving, pushing from Premiership Rugby in terms of marketing, central marketing, you know, individual club marketing. Do you think that's going to be a big facet? Because, you know, there are a lot of uncommitted out there who will come because, you know, they've heard about rugby, they've heard it's fun and you're not isolated. But I sometimes think that in terms of marketing, we've not made the best of it.
Yeah, I think I mean, the challenge is twofold for me. One of them is principally a sort of sporting thing, which where you know we're responsible for running a league and making sure that that's the most competitive and exciting league, and those clubs can compete on an international level. But the second one is a marketing role, really, and it's to promote and sell the league to rugby fans. And really, the vision for me on that is that clearly you have these sort of peak window moments with the international game. But you know what you've got, and the beauty of club rugby is it, you know, it's week in, week out, and it's for me, it's the beating heart of the English game. And so you want to make sure that beating heart is felt. And so that's where we have to collaborate more, both with ourselves and so with the clubs, with Prem Rugby, to make sure that noise is heard. But also, you know, I think we can collaborate more with our, you know, the other rugby stakeholders that we've got in our environment to try and tell a bit more of a collective story around the game and also the importance of the Premiership within that.
Simon, you mentioned that you're 3 weeks into the job, and I'm imagining in the middle of a global pandemic, it must feel like, what the hell have I done to myself here? But with that, what now that you've got your feet under the desk, what do you see as your greatest challenges with the Premiership?
I mean, I think there's five buckets for me really to sort of focus on. One of them, as we just talked around, is collaboration and telling rugby story and making sure that it grows. I think any sport is needing to have a more direct relationship with the fan and serve up what they want and to make it as specific to those fans as possible. So that's a big sort of transformational piece from how a lot of how we all work both at a club level and a league level. There's a definite need to continue to modernize the product, and that's whether that's in stadia, whether that's online, whether that's, you know, on screen with broadcast. And so there'll be a big focus on that. I think the other piece is around competitive and exciting rugby, and just, you know, I think our vital signs are good on that, but it's a constant watch out on. And this is when season format, this is when competition structure, things like salary cap, all that stuff leads into making sure those vital signs are healthy. So that will be a constant watch out. And I think the sort of final piece is really around future proofing. Really, you know, we've got a create a sort of sustainable league, really, that at a local level for the clubs. You know, they really have been through a really challenging time over the last couple of years, and it's set back a lot of their plans. And really, with that, we now need to sort of set a pathway where we can, you know, reach the point where clubs are sustainable and we don't have to rely so much on the benevolence and just sheer passion of the ownership group that we've got at the moment.
That was Simon Massey-Taylor of Premiership Rugby, the chief executive for 3 weeks, but hopefully for a long and successful future. Thank you, Simon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Simon. It was really nice to hear from him. We're going to go on to God or Goddess of the Week, but first, a little bit more chat about Eddie Jones and the endless controversies about England.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
I don't know, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Guys, Eddie Jones said recently that he would have to pick Owen Farrell at inside centre so that Marcus Smith, Eddie's obvious choice at 10, allegedly, would have someone to run the game for him. Well, not being able to run the game as an international 10 is slightly odd. Now we know that Owen Farrell is out. Will, does that muck up all of Eddie's so-called strategy?
Yeah, I think, and it's a fascinating one. So we're recording this before England put out a squad update, but the expectation is that there's a reprieve coming for George Ford. And I find that call fascinating, particularly for the psychology for Ford himself, a guy who's been unwanted for the last two squads and is basically being now picked on necessity. And I feel like, I don't know what you guys would think about it, but he's kind of been messed about a bit over the last few years. I mean, he was the Smith of kind of 10 years ago, the attacking guy who takes the ball to the line, and he became incredibly malleable to the game plan that the coaches wanted him to play. And now, and then was dropped because he was playing that way and wasn't playing the way they wanted to change the game to. The sort of England 2020 ways worked really well for Leicester, and that's counting against him. But bringing him back into the squad, he's an out-and-out fly half. So how does he approach it, knowing that Smith is the first choice?
But I think you said earlier, isn't the key choice now not at 10, but at 12?
Yeah, I mean, that's the next thing. So it would be fascinating if Orlando Bailey was the man who got injured over the weekend playing against Leinster, and it wasn't Farrell. I'm not sure whether Ford would have been the guy called up. I wonder if Eddie might have gone for someone like Charlie Atkinson as a young 10. Because 12's the interesting one, isn't it? I mean, Mark Atkinson's played once. He's the only real out-and-out 12 they've got in that squad, with Marchant, Northmore and Slade. Personally, I'd have Slade playing at 12, but it changes the dynamic and you need ball carriers elsewhere then.
Is there any chance now? Eddie says Marcus has to have Owen Farrell playing alongside him, mainly, I think, to try and get Owen in the team somewhere. But is there any way now that Eddie might swallow his pride and realise it's gone a bit too far and put George Ford 10?
Well, the interesting thing is, we know how close Ford and Farrell have been through the years, and a lot of talk that you've heard come out of England over the years is that these two together have put their brains as one and sort of masterminded the attacking shape that we've seen from England through the years. Ford was the one that was jettisoned, but Farrell was just too valuable a personality to get rid of in the England team, because he's just got such a force of will and he bends people around him to play a certain way. It doesn't. If that's the case, and I always find it fascinating, what we're talking about really at the moment is two fly halves who have weeks in a row won games at the death for their clubs. It just so happens that the clubs play two completely different styles. If this was 2 years ago, you'd imagine Ford would be a complete shoo-in, because that's what the tactical leanings of this England national team were. It played right into the style that George Ford is playing now. It sort of negates the conversation about 12, though, because, you know, Marchant is down. We expect him to see him as a centre, but he's been so valuable actually playing on the wing, particularly for Quinns, has been off high balls or running off someone's shoulder, has looked exceptional off the wing.
I think actually I'd have him over Johnny May and Watson if they were both injured. He's been so good.
Absolutely. So he's been in great form. And Slade, you always go, is he a 12, is he a 13, where do we play him? So whatever happens, we're now, if there's no one coming in at centre, suddenly you're looking at this, and this could all be academic, of course, but you look at that and you go, almost flip a coin for the fly-off. If Ford is as malleable as Will suggests and could play the style that we've come to expect from Smith, and certainly the way that England want to play after the November tests, great. That 10 conversation for me is... Who do you pick at centre now? Because why has Farrell got into this position where he is suddenly so valuable that we can't even have other guys in the squad that perform an exact same role as him? Yeah, yeah. And that's where it seems like Eddie Jones has had a blind spot.
I think he's disappeared in the direction of his own backside, actually, because I think it was all to try and counter press speculation and try and meld the team in a certain way. I would have... I think Atkinson is a grossly underrated player, and I think he's the only person they got to perform that sort of powerhouse. He's not just a sort of straight up and down smasher either. I mean, he's a clever player, and I would use him, and I would have Ford at 10. I'm sure he won't, but Al, if you're the Scottish coaches, say it's not a very nice day, who do you want to be at 10 for England? I reckon you want Marcus Smith.
You want to
play against Marcus Smith.
I think, as I say, both... Well, certainly if you're Scottish, you've got flashbacks of that game where Scotland were getting handily beaten. They suddenly came back after half-time and were roaring. And who was it that came in under the posts to snatch a draw from the jaws of defeat? It was Ford.
Yeah,
yes, he did that for England. So certainly there's it's a bit of the boogeyman about him. But I'm not joking when I say that if you're Scottish, you could flip a coin. I think what's scary about both those tens and why it was probably a bit of relief that Ford wasn't in the squad to begin with is because of what these guys are doing week in, week out for their clubs. They are snatching, they are grasping wins, and they are making things happen at the death, which particularly in something that, if this Six Nations is going to be as tight as we keep hearing, that's what scares you.
Fair point.
What approach do you take as George Ford now? So we're recording this on Monday when England are joining up in the afternoon in Brighton for a training camp week. You've been told that you're surplus to requirements, but now you're back in out of necessity. Eddie Jones has nailed his colours to the mast that Smith is his fly half, and nailed his colours to the mast that Farrell is his captain and his 12. So you're only, as George Ford, seemingly coming in as a stopgap filler and a mentor to Marcus Smith, maybe, who's the guy who's taking your shirt. So I just find that he's going to be competitive. He's going to want to start at Murrayfield if he can. But how do you approach that, knowing that you're basically the guy that he didn't want?
And the most amazing thing is, and I mean, I'm just going to ask you a final question each. Al, as a front row expert, I'm going to ask you who you'd have at... I'll come back to you in a minute. Al, who you'd have in the key tight end prop position with big question marks there. Will, I'm asking you what your back row would be and who would be playing where. But before you say that, there is one point I'd like to make about George Ford. Eddie Jones announced a squad of 36. Why on God's earth could he not make one of them George Ford? He had to make this huge point. He reduced himself to two fly halves, one of whom had not played for months and is now not going to play for a few more months. There was no reason in the 36-man squad why George Ford wouldn't be in there, and he's out because of Eddie's dogma, and now he's got to do what we call in journalism a reverse ferret. Al, tight head prop.
The selection itself tells you exactly what the direction of travel is. It has to be Cal Sinclair. There's just so few options. The way that they've designed this squad, the way that they've called up players, means that you have to go with Sinclair, or you decide, we've given Stewart enough caps, will we give him a go? Okay, his squad, his club side is, he's not having a good time. Maybe the light relief will be playing in a Six Nations Calcutta Cup clash. Oh, fantastic, great. So it has to be Sinclair, and it watching Cal Sinclair this season has been fascinating, because he's sort of, whilst Bristol have been going up and down, I've watched him a bit, and all sorts happened. I remember watching him against Genge one-on-one, and him sort of losing his rag with the referee, almost, with the where the decisions were being going, and even the match official having to say, take a breath,
calm down,
let's go here. Is that the kind of, is he in the right headspace to pitch into a match like this? You, as an England fan, you'd absolutely hope so. As Cal Sinclair, you'd absolutely hope so. But the hands are almost tied by the selection, and there's you have to say what the development is like in certain positions, because if you look at Loosehead as well, Bevan Rodd has jumped on, but he was a selection out of necessity because of injuries. Joe Marler is so vital to this England team. He is so important that any niggle to him and you're suddenly going right, this learning curve's pretty steep for the rest of these guys. Let's see how far we can climb them. Get your crampons ready, lads.
Okay, so Al's obvious, he's going for Marler and Sinclair. One because of an excellent player, the other because probably no one's bubbling up underneath. Back row, please, Will.
Yeah, I think I'm sticking with what I said last week. And Courtney Laws at 6, Tom Curry in his proper position at 7. And now that England have options at number 8, you can do that. And I think I would plump to start with Alex Donbrandt, knowing that Smith and the telepathy that they have together is vital. And then it's an amazing bench that they could put out with Sam Simmons. I mean, the great stat from the weekend was that he scored his 75th Exeter try in his 100th club game.
That's unbelievable.
It's crazy, isn't it? And they both scored
hat-tricks. Is he allowed to bring Ewers and Kirsten?
Yeah, well, that's with him. The latches.
As long as you can bring his mates with him. Yeah. That's a fair point. I think I'd agree with your back row. Possibly I might start with Sam Simmons. But we'll move on now to God or Goddess of the Week. We start with Will, I think, to give myself and Al extra time to think.
Yeah, well, I'm very prepared for this because I was watching the games. I wasn't actually working yesterday, but I was doing a huge shift for the Ruck, watching lots of rugby yesterday, and The best moment, hands down, we love a prop on this podcast, was Bevan Rodd's, Ben Curry's turnover. He takes the ball, finds himself through a hole, and then picks out an unbelievable pass off his right hand to Reed in the corner. And it was just sensational stuff.
There,
love it.
There he goes by the grace of Rod.
In Rod we trust.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you what, it's hard for me to argue with that, because obviously I'm completely biased to the front row guys. But I toyed whether this was going to be a gods or devil of the week, actually, which way to go with it. I don't know if we saw that moment where Wayne Barnes, quick as you like, gave a second yellow card to Tolu Latu. And listening back on the television, you know that annoying thing where commentators are always like, "We're sorry if you picked up any bad language on the mic." Well, Wayne Barnes relayed word for word what was said to him by Tolu Latu, and it was a string of expletives that got him the second yellow card. So I don't know whether it's to make Wayne Barnes God of the Week for that yellow card, or Tolu Latu the Devil of the Week. Pick and choose. We'll have one on each shoulder, I suppose.
Okay. Well, that's all right. That's allowed. The God and the Devil. So Wayne was the devil or the god?
Wayne was the god.
He's a god. Well, listen, I've two good ones there. I've considered B.E. Allo for a third week running, but I don't think I can sustain it this time. I'm going to give it to a guy I've been critical of, because I think he's a bizarre bloke, stroppy with referees. But when you see Johnny Sexton play like he did against Bath, with a kind of magisterial command of all he surveys, and the vision and the pace and the accuracy, and how good he made Henshaw, Ringrose, what, I don't say anything, they're not good anyway. It was just a devastating exhibition of attacking rugby. So Johnny Sexton for me.
Sexton has an incredible self-awareness as well, because after the game he was asked about Ireland playing Wales and Dan Bigger being selected as captain for Wales, and he implied the referee's in for a hell of a time with both of us.
Which is true.
Can I just give an honourable mention as well? Just before we came on the podcast, a prestigious award was given out, the Rugby Union Writers Club Pat Marshall Memorial Award, and we can exclusively reveal, depending on when you're listening to this, who won.
Well, I can tell you, if you like, the runners-up. The Pat Marshall Award, given by the Rugby Writers, is the oldest individual award in rugby. The contenders this year, the shortlist, was Dan Leo for everything he's done for Pacific Rugby, Marcus Smith, Simon Middleton, Alan Wynne-Jones, Anton DuPont, and Zoe Allcroft, who's been absolutely brilliant for the England women's team in the pack. Will, the Pat Marshall, the recipient of the Pat Marshall Award is?
It was Antoine Dupont. What a year he has. I mean, World Rugby Player of the Year in the men's game, European Player of the Year, European Cup winner, top 14, and then he gets the best one of all, the Pat Marshall. And
you're forgetting Rugby World named him the best player in the world as well.
And top 100 Rugby World as well.
Okay.
Is there anything
he hasn't won?
Well, he was the first French winner, here's the stat, since 1981, Jean-Pierre Rive.
He was also, as a final word, he was also one of our gods of the week not so long ago. Thanks so much for listening to The Ruck. Please subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcast from. One more treat to come this week. Al.
Yeah, keep your ears peeled. Is that a phrase people say? Keep your ear out for a special podcast coming from the team at The Ruck here, where we take a look, delve into all the narratives of the Six Nations that's coming ahead, and how excited we are for that.
And when's that out, Al?
That should be out on Tuesday, so keep your eyes on all of your feeds.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.